The 1989 murder of RSPCA officer Stuart Fairley highlighted the dangers posed for workers in the enforcement field who worked solo or one-up in rural areas of Australia.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Though the brutality sent shockwaves through the national community, the case also brought to light the potentially dangerous situations welfare workers can be exposed to while serving their community. Retired homicide detective Charlie Bazina joins us this week to share his recollections of the investigation, the trial, and the aftermath of this brutal, shocking crime.
So we usually start with when, how and when did this case first cross your desk, Charlie? When did you first hear about Stuart Fairley?
Well, the case of Stuart Fairley back on the 1st of May 1989 was actually a missing persons investigation. And we didn't have the missing persons unit we have today under the homicide umbrella. Stuart Fairley, being an RSPCA officer, had attended a farm at Mortlake in relation to a report of cruelty to some horses. So he went out there on the 1st of May and he was never seen again. So based on that, it was a missing persons left with the local detectives at Warrnambool. And it wasn't until 7 days later that they found his battered body some distance away, probably 10 kilometres away from where he was last seen at this man's farm.
So in these days, this is 1989, right? So what sort of processes did the RSPCA have at that stage? They didn't have mobile phones, or did they?
No.
No.
No mobile phones that I was aware of. Certainly, if they were around, Stuart never had one.
Did he have a sort of radio in his car, or what was the process when you go out?
Well, basically, I think he was. Here's your motor car.
Yep.
He was living at Clifton Springs, so Stuart Fairley, with his wife, and he'd just get his jobs, and away he'd go.
Okay.
So basically, we don't have the... Then it wasn't the big emphasis we have on work safe and work cover, that type of thing. He was one up, and he would go about his business and do his investigations and come back, and then eventually probably go to the Burwood offices once or twice a week and do what he needs to do.
Uh-huh.
And that's how they would do it. So I think as a result of this particular murder, processes were changed quite dramatically within the RSPCA. You look at the police sort of thing at the moment after the number of police murders. One up, police no longer work one up anymore because of that sheer safety issue that that police officers have, or anyone really in the in that particular enforcement field of working one up. It's always a risk, always a risk.
So would it have been his wife then who would have reported him missing?
I can't remember whether it was his wife. I dare say it would have been initially because he was due home that evening. And he was only, let's say, Clifton Springs, which is a suburb of Geelong. And he was going out to Mortlake, which is just past up near Camperdown, Colac Way, give people some idea, in a western district. And he would go about his business. I think he was He was going to Glen Ormston College after that, which is again a college of agricultural college nearby.
God, so he had a massive area, didn't he, that was his to patrol.
That's so very much so.
It would have taken people a while to realise that he was not.
That's right. And then, so basically, our involvement became in when reporters missing persons, so it's left at that level in those days. Nothing was sinister at that stage. You look, people, because of the communication gap that, look, he might have gone elsewhere. He might have gone to do another investigation, unbeknownst to the RSPCA officers, unbeknownst to anyone else. So there was no initial concern, the fact he didn't turn up for that evening. And then it just built up momentum whilst he was reported missing. And the fallacy you that keep on hearing within our organisation or in our community that, a person's got to be reported... A person's got to be missing 24 hours before they get reported missing. Well, that's all rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, there is no, that's in America probably, but not in Victoria, where if you've got grave concerns of a loved one or someone you know or someone, a work colleague or whatever, that should be in a location, you know, go to the police and report them as a missing person because it's out of character. And those crucial early period of time for a police investigation to commence, and more so, and more predominantly and more acutely, is the safety of that person. If, you know, we look at the bushwalkers and the likes, we've got to get the people out there straight away. Sure, it's resource heavy on resources and et cetera, but it's the safety of that person. It's out of character. He should have been here or she should have been here. It's not this, it's not that. And and for a police officer then to turn someone away and say, you know what, they've not been missing long enough. And so, no, they must then start an investigation. And then if it then escalates, missing persons at a local level, goes now to our missing persons unit, which is under the umbrella of the homicide squad. You know, this sounds a little bit sinister. then they can now do a full investigation as a missing persons unit, and if it turns into a homicide, they can then do it. In the early days, when I was involved, for example, in the society murders, the missing persons unit was just in its early stages. When they found the body, I was on call, or the bodies, then I was running in unison with the missing persons. Now their skills are up in the missing persons unit that they can now do a full-blown homicide investigation. So under that umbrella, homicide squad, you got missing persons unit and the cold case unit, and they're having great successes.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah. It feels like we hear quite regularly of big breakthroughs, don't we?
Yeah.
So Charlie, what was the nature of the investigation that Stuart was going out to see? Like, why was he going out to this particular place? Well,
there had been a neighbour not too far away from the property owned by a fellow called Leonard Paul Squire. Now, Leonard Squire was a bachelor, and he was breeding horses. Not so much, we're not in the realms of thoroughbred horses, racing and the likes, but he was breeding horses, so lived there on his own, and clearly a neighbour living nearby had seen a number of his horses that were malnutritioned. So based on that, they, as you would expect, did a report to RSPCA officers of cruelty to animals, being the horses. That then went filtered down to who's in that area. It's clearly Stuart Fairley, that's his area in the Western region. And he then went out and started his investigation. Nothing untoward. Stuart Fairley was not known to the police at all, so there was no issues. What the inquiries the RSPCA would have done, I'm not too sure, but it would have been because they don't have the process of being able to say, well, we're sending out our people to these locations. Do we know, does he have any police history and the likes? So I don't know whether the RSPCA have now got that they can do an inquiry of where they're sending their people to make sure they're not known, are there firearms. And you've got to work on the premise also that as an RSPCA officer, you are going, and anyone going to a rural property, you've got to work on the premise that there are going to be firearms on the property. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a farm.
Yeah.
So you've got to be cautious. So I think Stuart would arrive there, and we know he left this particular day. And what is interesting, which will come into play as I go into the investigation, that going the distance he was, he fueled up his motor car at Geelong. And that was a good investigative tool for us because in fueling up, they have to give their mileage. And that played a role down the track when we found his motor car. So, again, another avenue of inquiry. So he attended the property in the late morning of this particular, on the 1st of May. We know that he went to the courthouse at Camperdown and made some inquiries there over another matter. And then he then attended at the home or the farm of Leonard Squire in Coonawarren Lane in Mortlake and conducted his investigations there and never seen or heard of again. So it remained with Warrnambool CIB. They did their investigation on his missing persons. Couldn't find anything. A number of days later, his motor car, he's being Stuart Fairley's motor car, was found secreted behind some pine trees not far off Coonawarren Lane where he was last seen. And it was found there. And then after we then found the bodies, or the search and rescue actually found the bodies, or body, was when we were called in. So we were called in. We find the body. We find that it's a battered body. And there was two graves, actually. There was the body, or the grave of Stuart Fairley with the body in a shallow grave underneath some trees. And another grave was his notes that he was taking at the time. There was a camera and a few other little personal items. So why they did it in two holes, I don't particularly know. So we had nothing to go on. So we had the body, we had the motor car, and we started the investigation there on. So clearly, you then got to work backwards. Having found the body, we know his last place of he was investigating, was all documented, was the home of Leonard Paul Squire in Coonawarren Lane. So you start drawing this picture, and along Coonawarren Lane, probably 10 kilometres from the farmhouse, along Coonawarren Lane is where the body was found. And then if you draw a diagonal line from where the body is found and the farm, probably in a triangular fashion, is where the motor car was found, probably some 2 or 3 kilometres behind these pine plantations. So it was within that area of Leonard Squire. So, you know, we work on the premise, you then got to eliminate people. So that we have to eliminate the person who last saw the person alive, the person who finds the body, et cetera, et cetera. So our first port of call was obviously Lenny Squire. So he gave us a story. We attended there, and sure enough, his horses were there malnutrition. There was a reason for it. You know, he wasn't earning a very lot of money. He was doing a pie run from a local pie shop in Mortlake, So he'd become a person of interest for us. So we've got to start eliminating those initial people, then we move on. As the investigation progressed, you know, we've put out a lot of media in relation to the sighting of this particular motor car. It was a Ford station wagon marked on the site RSPCA. And it's amazing the responses you then get. We were getting sightings of what people thought was RSPCA motor cars as far north as New South Wales and the likes all over, because people, you know, whilst we look for that assistance, people sort of say, oh, was it this car? It could have been RSCV motor car. Yeah. And they've sort of built into it. And that's why during any investigation, it's very mindful we start releasing, say, photo fits or composite drawings of particular suspects. We get inundated with hundreds of calls. Oh, that looks like Billy Brown. Oh, that looks like Billy Smith. Mm. Or that looks like John Citizen, or whatever the case may be.
Same with missing persons, right?
Correct.
Mm, yeah.
So we were getting a lot of sightings with this motor car, trying to draw it all back, and we could not get away from the fact that we then started to believe he did not leave that farm alive. Mm. Because that's where all the evidence took us.
Mm.
His job was that Stuart Fairley was then going to Glen Ormiston College, which is an agricultural college just out of Camperdown, but he never made it there. Mm. So what's happened? And all that Stuart, Leonard Squire was telling us, he left here around lunchtime. I don't know what happened to him. And that was his story. And we couldn't budge him from that. He didn't deviate from that story at all. So we continued on doing our investigations. And during that investigation, we then we're getting these other sightings, as I say, of his motor car around the place. Then, you know, we were quite confident that the person we were going to be looking at very, very closely was Lenny Squire, because in the second grave where his body was found was his notes. And they were handwritten notes, and they were abruptly stopped. How many horses have you got? Da, da, da. Question, answer. And they abruptly stopped. All right. Okay, well, why would they abruptly stop if he finished his inquiry and left, as Squire tells us? Again, suspicion started to grow more and more against Squire. We found the camera also in the second grave, and one of my bunning detectives said, you know, we developed the photographs. We didn't know what that was going to show. And during, we did a bit of a reenactment. We went onto the farm and we said, okay, Leonard, tell us what did Stuart Fairley do when he got onto the farm. He walked us around. He went here, he went there, he went there. Interestingly enough, he took us to a gate halfway in the middle of his property. And he said, he stood here, looked at my stock, and he left. He said, I'll just feed him some more. And he really played down the malnutrition of his horses. So basically we said, okay, he didn't go past this gate. No, he never went past this gate. So we then developed the photographs in his camera. And in one particular photograph is a picture of a horse behind this gate. And then we found that this particular gate was hundreds of yards down further in his property, which went against what Squire had told us.
Yeah.
So the suspicion is growing more and more.
Mm.
Why would he lie to us about that? So what we ended up doing with that particular photograph, because Squire said to us he left my farm at a certain time, we then went to Melbourne University and someone said, one of my detectives said, we can get a time off that photograph. So we got an astronomer and a surveyor to look at that photograph, and they were able to tell us plus or minus 5 minutes when that photograph was taken. So we knew what day he was there, and we said, okay, we can convincingly say he was only on this property on this day. And if you can imagine, it was like a sundial. So what these calculations were, plus or minus 5 minutes, they could say that that photograph was taken at 1:30 or 1:35. Or 125, 5 minutes either way, which went against what we were told initially by Squire. So, again, everything points back. You go away, you look at a big wide net, everything keeps coming back to Squire.
This conversation, though, I have to say, Charlie, is reminding me of you were the first former detective I ever spoke to, I ever interviewed.
Yep.
And I remember you telling me something that I had never understood, which was the importance of overproving.
Yeah.
Everything.
Very
because
much.
When we come to court,
correct,
these details are crucial because this is how a case can fall over.
Absolutely.
So I'm sure we have listeners thinking to themselves, well, obviously this guy killed him. Why are you going to all this trouble?
Correct.
And this is why. This is what your job really is, isn't it? It is these kinds of details so that you know that a year or 2 years or however long it takes down the track, when you're in court, all of these details are covered meticulously.
Yep.
And this guy's defence cannot get you on anything.
Absolutely. And
it's incredible.
doing an investigation, like any good investigator should, they should be in defence mode all the time.
Yeah.
Where's my Achilles heels and my defence? Yep. We will never know, and this is the whole justice system. The justice systems that we work under is there to protect the innocent, but in protecting the innocent, it protects the guilty.
Yeah.
Now, we've got to think about where are our weaknesses in that case. So basically, every little bit, because we do not know what defences he will then put up at a trial 18 months or 2 years down the
because
track.
Because his lawyer has 2 years to try and think them up.
Correct.
Yeah.
And because they get every shred of piece of paper of evidence we're going to send against this person. There's nothing, we don't hold back any evidence. The law says, in fairness to the accused person, he must get every shred of evidence that we are going to allege against this person. So the solicitor can sit there with his clerks and say, go through this brief with a fine-tooth comb and find our holes. Have the police done everything by procedure? Have police done that correctly? Have they obtained that evidence correctly? Have they taken out the warrant correctly? And they will look through everything. So whilst we work by the rules, crooks don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if we deviate one little bit in a rule or procedure, that could cost us the case.
So if they can say, well, you can't prove that's the same horse and that's the same paddock. Yeah.
Correct.
That he could have moved on to another investigation and taken that photo at another place. So if the police are wrong about that, they could be wrong about the whole case.
Correct.
End of story.
Correct.
Unless
we need to go overboard. So we then go back and take a photograph of that same position.
Yeah.
That is the same gate. There's the same horse. So we can show to the jury.
Yeah.
Because think about it this way. We, being the prosecution, have to convince 12 strangers who have never met before in that jury box that the person in the dock killed that person beyond reasonable doubt.
Mm.
And all the defence have to do is create a reasonable doubt and they then say, do you have a reasonable doubt? You must acquit. And that's what we've got to every little nook and cranny. That's why the pinnacle of a homicide investigation is now coming back. You're investigating the loss of a person's life.
Mm.
You get one shot at it and you've got to do the best you can. And unfortunately, you've got to balance that with getting as much as strong evidence as you can and to delay it and leave this person in society. He may kill again.
Mm.
He or she may kill again. So you might have to say, well, we've got enough evidence to charge them. And you always work on the premise that if I'm going to arrest this person, they're better educated today, they are going to say no comment.
Mm.
Us investigators have to build a case around a person because we know we bring this person in, my name, address, date of birth, occupation, I'm going to interview you, no comment. Well, we've got to go somewhere. We work on strategies. So based on this particular one with Squire, that was his story. I'm telling you, Charlie, this guy came in here, he investigated me. There was no animosity, there's no problem. Okay, you know, they were a little bit lean. That was his excuse. He didn't make it sound serious. And then, it's subjective about how badly these horses were treated. And he told me about, I've got a feed and miss, and I'll come back in about 2 or 3 weeks' time and relook at it. And if you're doing okay, fantastic. So there was no indication he was going to charge him based on what Squire was telling us.
Mm.
So we could prove all that. So every little bit we had to then prove. So, but everything Cook always brought us back to Squire. So come the day that we said, you know what, it became a strong circumstantial case. We had nothing DNA-wise to tie him to the murder.
Mm.
We found nothing incriminating on the property. The fact is you were the last person to see him alive. He never attended at Glen Ormiston College where his next stop-off was. And then we start getting witnesses coming forward. Just to go back a step, what we ended up doing to say to, again, clarify he couldn't have gone anywhere else because we were getting sightings of what people thought was Fairley's motor car as far as New South Wales and the likes. But again, all good assisting people are thinking they're doing the right thing. Nothing malicious about it. And that's what we expect. So you then got to look at it, look at every information that comes in. So as luck had it, as I said earlier, he fueled up at Geelong and put a mileage down. So we had a highway patrol car, knew where we'd fueled up. We did a mileage check. And we were within a number of small kilometres that we find out what his final mileage is when we find his motor car.
Mm.
So we can then prove all the sightings in New South Wales, he couldn't have been there because the mileage doesn't support it. So we then have to say, because if someone says to us, well, hang on, Charlie, your investigation through this witness says his car was seen in Balranald in New South Wales. Well, what about that? How could it have been murdered up there and then brought back here, whoever the case may be, creating a reasonable doubt? We can then say no, because we did a mileage check. He couldn't have done much distance beyond going to the Geelong to Camperdown, Mortlake, and Mortlake to where his motor car was found.
Mm.
And you start tightening it up. So having done that, then we had a number of other witnesses come forward after we charged Squire with the murder. They said, hang on, we saw Stuart Fairley in Camperdown in the afternoon of the 1st of May.
Mm.
And we're saying to ourselves, that's impossible. He was dead at the time. And we support that by the mileage. You couldn't have gone anywhere else. And we say he was dead because he was dead when he was taken off the property at Squire's. And we could show that from the whole investigation we had. But these two particular witnesses we had said, no, we saw this person because his face was on the media.
Mm.
And we say they were mistaken. So the more we challenged these people, the more they dug in and said, no, I'm telling you, I saw him at Camperdown in the afternoon of the 1st of May. Then there was another witness who worked at a location. She said, I saw the RSPCA motor car driving past in the afternoon. And we said, we knew that was impossible because all the evidence showed that he was dead at the time.
Mm. Do you then have to look at these witnesses and find out if they've got any, like, skin in the game? Like,
sure, but,
you know, if they're making it up or mistaken.
Yeah, but I think there was a good-minded people.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's what they...
And it's what they honestly think.
Exactly. And it's perception. It wasn't malicious.
Yeah.
The fact is, you know, you may have seen him on a different time. You got this mixed up or whatever. No, I'm telling you. And then that's what human nature is.
Well, and also because we think memory is perfect, don't we?
Mm. Correct.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important for us as investigators to get to witnesses as soon as possible. Because with time, memories fade.
Yeah.
That's why we take statements. Because if we charge someone today, 18 months, 2 years, we get to a trial, and it's that memory prompt. And it's, the importance of taking detailed statements of people. That's a recall. Oh, that's right.
Mm.
And they remember it. And we are then, even to our young police officers, we say to them, and investigators, notes are so significant in taking notes, because you're going to be cross-examined by significant QCs at the Supreme Court. Well, how do you remember that? You've done X amount of investigations. Why do you then identify these particular stuff? You know why? Because at the time I took my notes. Here they are here.
Mm-hmm.
And that sits down the QC every time. So powerful in taking notes and us making notes of what people's recall is. But we know as investigators that 10 people can look at one incident and give you 5 or 10 different perceptions of what they saw. And you accept that. But you then, as long as they don't collude, but these particular witnesses, they believed in what they saw. So we then, as investigators, we put up all the evidence that exculpates the accused and also it inculpates the accused. We don't be selective. It is the role of the investigator to collect the facts and present them to the court, all the facts. We don't be selective. We cannot be. It is the role of the courts to identify innocence or guilt, not the investigator. We work on reasonable grounds. We reasonably believe that you are the person responsible for it. It's all alleged. That's why it's alleged that you've done this. It's alleged. And it's not until that person is convicted that we can then say you did murder this person. All prior to that, it's alleged. We're only alleging that you did it based on the evidence we've found. So realistically, after doing the arrest of Squire, it was a significantly 100% circumstantial case. It was there, the photographs, the notes stopping midstream. We had the other evidence that supported he was at another location, but we had to deal with that and rely on the jury.
After the break, Charlie details more of the trial. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Charlie tells us more about the details of the trial, as well as how the outcome of this case has affected the wider welfare community.
So we ended up had about 84 witnesses that we were running with. Again, nothing to tie him in. We didn't have the DNA issues that we had. But even if we found DNA on Fairley, well, of course he was on my property. Of course my DNA is on him. You know, there's always an excuse to it, but we then have to leave that to a jury to decide. So we had a 9-week trial, which was quite significant in those days.
It's Warnable. Pretty long.
Yeah, so we would go down for the week, me and my offsider, and we'd stay the week, come home weekends, go back on Sunday night.
But, I mean, you would have had other cases.
Yeah.
You know.
But your team runs with it. But whilst we're running that trial, we're doing other cases whilst the investigation is running.
Okay.
But it was myself and my sergeant at the time that were running on this particular one whilst the rest of the team were doing the other work.
Mm.
So it just doesn't stop. People have got to realise when a homicide team gets an investigation of a murder to do, that's one of probably 10 or 15 they've already got, plus the unsolved ones.
Mm.
So it goes on and on. So at the end of the day, we did our investigation. He denied it. So we ended up charging him based on our beliefs, on a circumstantial belief that the Squire was our offender based on the evidence. And we take that very, very seriously because we know we start charging people that they're going to be in custody for a start off, because ultimately it's only the Supreme Court that can give someone bail. The offence of murder, it's a show cause. Other offences, the police have to show cause why he shouldn't be given bail. The offence of murder, it's a show cause that they have to show cause to the Supreme Court why they should be given bail.
Right.
So once we know quite significantly that we start charging someone with murder, they're going to be in custody for some time before they get to the Supreme Court to apply for bail. So again, we charge Squire.
Was he an old guy? For some reason, I have a feeling.
Yeah, elderly gentleman. Yeah, elderly, absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So did they give it a bit of that? Did they try and sort of, because he was an older gentleman?
Oh, yeah, and his health wasn't the best.
Yep.
You know, he lived quite simply on the farm on his own.
Mm.
And basically his only income was running this pie run at Mortlake. So we called 84 witnesses, a 9-week trial, basically a circumstantial case, had a lot of false sightings. We had the fuel and mileage check that we did, the camera that we developed and the likes. And ultimately you run the trial, and after the trial, you know, the jury came back a number of times and we can't get a verdict, and the judge kept sending them back because, you know, it was a significant time for a trial, so we really needed a decision. And as you know, with murder, it's got to be a unanimous decision. They get 12 strangers to come up with one decision.
Well, I'm shocked that they couldn't.
And they couldn't. Mm, so ultimately, they come back as what we call a hung jury. Now, hung jury is to say, well, we can't come up with a definitive guilty or not guilty. So what happens then is that was a country trial, so it was adjourned off to retrial him at Melbourne.
Mm.
So, you know, strangely as it may be, that unlike America, where you're not permitted to then go and canvass jurors, sometimes jurors come to the trial and see the sentence after a guilty verdict and the like. So, but whilst we were down at Warrnambool, after a period of time, we bumped into a juror who we didn't know, and he came actually approached us and said, well, you know, Charlie, I can tell you it was 11-1. Huh? 11 guilty, mm-hmm. 1 not guilty. And there was one juror that basically indicated prior to hearing any evidence that this particular juror would not convict this person.
But isn't that like wrong? You can't correct. Do that?
What should have happened is, in those circumstances, that juror should have been reported to the jury keeper,
yeah.
who then goes to the tip staff, who then goes to the judge and says, this person is making a decision already based on this comment.
Mm-hmm.
They would have then got rid of that whole jury, yeah. and sworn in a new jury.
But do you know why? Was it a personal relationship? Was it a...
I don't believe it was. Just
problem
the fact
with the RSPCA? Was
yeah, but, you know, you've got to think about country people.
Yeah.
Think differently to us city folk. And not in a bad way. It's not derogative in any way. It's a matter of, you know, they're more close-knit. And the fact is whether this particular juror was sorry for him, or there was this, you know, and he was a very short gentleman, very meek and mild, spoke very softly, and they said, well, I don't want that on my conscience, or whatever reason it was.
Mm.
But that jury should have been discharged and a new jury. But we didn't know that, and we had to live with it. So we then go to the second trial at Melbourne, inexplicably again, based on that, on the jury. No one knows what happens in the jury room. He was acquitted.
No, really?
Yeah, why can't you find out what happens in the jury room?
Because, yeah, not by law. Because that would then, you know, put the jurors in certain places.
Like they could get bribed or
whatever.
Coerced or something.
It protects the jury.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
Say, well, they're there and there anonymously by name and who they are. We as investigators accept that. You know, since that time, probably 4 years later, Squire died of leukemia. But, you know, that remains unsolved. But in our heart of hearts, we know that he's the offender. We've got to work by the rules. We couldn't convince 12 people. And we were attacked quite significantly. Myself and my offside were attacked by the defence of being incompetent, of being selective. And so much so that I can tell you that we went to our police union because we were actually defamed in relation to our incompetence. And once we get defamed in relation to our credibility, that's our life as investigators.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we then looked at it and said, well, hang on, we go to the next investigation. Mm. And they'll say, wasn't it true, Mr. Bazzina, that in the Leonard Squire trial that you were called, you were incompetent, your credibility, you actually were incompetent and the likes. So we lose that credibility, it's gone.
Mm.
So we actually got an opinion through our police union by a senior QC in defamation. He said, yeah, you've got a good case. But it was the rules, and it probably still is, that they will not fund, our union won't fund defamation. So we had to live with that. We had to live with that criticism. And police officers get criticised every day of the week in the witness box.
Yeah.
You're incompetent, you're a liar, you're this to that, you've just made this up, you've done that, you've done this. And, you know, we've got to cop that on the chin. That's what we do for a living. Criticisms, and you say, well, no, it is what it is. And we live on our credibility and our integrity.
Yep.
It's so paramount as investigators.
You've got to be absolutely above the law, as they say.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And Stuart Fairley's family have had to live with this twice with two juries not finding this guy guilty. And if not him, then who on earth else?
Correct.
So who did the what did the defence propose as an alternative scenario?
Do they have to propose an alternative?
No, they don't. There was during the investigation, there was another gentleman identified in the local area who was very aggressive and had actually run-ins with Fairley before.
Right.
Reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt.
Okay.
All this type of stuff. And we were able to eliminate him. He was alibied. He was all this type of stuff. He was an avenue of inquiry we did. Because we have to present every piece of evidence. If we don't, the defence will. It's not up to the defence to prove anything. The prosecution must prove everything beyond reasonable doubt. So we had other red herrings during the investigation because, okay, it's like police force. RSPCA were there prosecuting people for cruelty towards animals. So they weren't a popular people.
No. So highly emotive when it comes to animals and legal things.
And more so in the farm when it becomes, that's their living.
Yeah.
And you're going to shut me down, are you going to charge me for this? Well, I can't afford a vet, I can't afford this.
Yeah.
And certainly Squire couldn't afford. Yeah. He couldn't afford the particular feed, he couldn't afford veterinarians and the like. So the animals were suffering. So he knew the writing was on the wall. So either the fact that he's been challenged by this RSPCA officer and he was battered to death, and what we put together was, with the evidence we were leading, is the fact that he was on the property, that Squire saw no way out of it, he was on school, he's assaulted Squire, battered him to death, put him in his own motor car, Fairley's motor car. I don't remember whether we found any blood or anything in that regard, but there was, I just remembered, there was a plastic hessian-type bag over the head of Squire, so there was no blood outwardly. And also, what did we find in the garage of Squire? The same type of hessian plastic bag.
So he put it on to protect the car from
and the blood and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So he's battered him to death, gathered all the stuff. Now, whether he waited for nightfall, he's driven 10 kilometres up the road, you know, and we find a lot of offenders are lazy, a bit like the society murders. The fact is that he then drove him 10 kilometres on the same road that he lives on, finds a spot.
Yeah.
Probably off the road it was about 40, 50 metres. He dug two holes, puts a body in one, another hole for the jacket and photo and paperwork and the camera and the likes. He then drives the motor car probably another 4 or 5 kilometres to where it was dumped behind these pine plantations, and then he was able to walk back to his farm. Everything was magnetic back to Squire.
Oh, and it was a brutal death too, wasn't it? It was like bashed to death.
It was savage. And he then said, okay, saw no issues there and just waited for us to come along, and which we did, and one thing led to another and we end up interviewing him. Never, ever admitted it.
He's cocky or overconfident?
Well, the whole thing is lucky. The whole thing is that we found no other significant incriminating. If we had found any blood trail at the farm, if we found this, that would have been the hitch. But again, the prosecution must prove beyond reasonable doubt that this is the person that committed the offence. We had false sightings of the car. We had sightings of the two witnesses in there. That weakened our case significantly. But we've got to work by the rules. Crooks don't. We have to prove our case beyond everyone else to say, well, he couldn't have been. You know, why wouldn't he have gone to Glen Ormiston College? He didn't go there because he was dead. He'd never left your farm alive. No. And he was represented by the local solicitor from Warrnambool. And, you know, from the get-go, we did a video reenactment on his farm when we went to arrest him. But, you know, that remains unsolved because it's a solved case when someone's convicted. He was never convicted, so that remains unsolved. So there is a false, I suppose, account of the figures. When you get how many unsolved cases of homicides have you got in Victoria? But realistically, well, they're unsolved because it's like the Gangitano murder that I did. Now, Jason Moran, Graham Kinnebury, implicit in that murder, was found by an inquest.
Yeah.
That remains unsolved and will never be solved. So that's a false accounting to say, well, no, that's solved. To me, it's a solve when I've charged someone. Not that I've charged Moran or anyone, but evidence points to that person. But our law says until that person is actually convicted, they are innocent. And it's like when you say to people, well, okay, whilst it affects us and the families when someone gets acquitted, you know, the families become our support. They support us and say, you know, we know you've done 110%.
Yeah.
The fact is, that's what the court system is. It protects it also protects the guilty and protecting the innocent. and we just couldn't prove it beyond reasonable doubt. So all of that, you then walk away. You learn from each case you do. You become better at doing your work and become, open up your mind of your avenues of inquiry, of eliminating everybody else. But you are in defence mode. The defence have to prove nothing. We have to prove everything. Is the jury system the best one we've got? Maybe it might be like Europe and that we have judges sitting alone. Again, that's a major debate. Is our jury system working as it should be? There's always going to be debate.
It's a lot to trust people, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Strangers. A lot of faith to put into randos, effectively. Yeah. There is still the RSPCA plaque and memorial to Stuart Fairley at the Burwood campus here in Melbourne. There's a lovely photo here of his son Ian, unveiling that plaque.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s. And, I guess that's all there is. His family's just had to come to terms with.
Well, it's cost Stuart his life to bring a legacy of better protection for their officers. So, it hasn't gone, I suppose unnoticed, the fact that he was a legacy for that, that now it's a lot more safer.
Yeah.
From that point on, we'll just say, we need to really look at the safety of our officers going into the field. And it's across the board. You've got the environment protection people. Yes. Any enforcement agency that's out in the field, more so in the rural area, are very, very mindful of contacts and having that that support in relation to radios, GPS locations, telephones, knowing where they're going to be, looking for the history, ring in when you finish the farm. So that's become a lot in. This was a catalyst of getting things done through unfortunately, it cost Stuart his life.
Mm. It often happens that way, doesn't it? Something really tragic happens and then it's...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, then we look at it. We don't risk manage as good as we can. Corporately they do it. Factories and the likes of saying, there's a risk there. You need to put a guard on that one. You've got to put a training on that one. You've got to do that. But even from the policing perspective, that we now no longer work one up on rural patrols in motor cars, on traffic highway patrols, on motorcycles. After hours you don't work. We work in two motorcycles. That's just the world we live in, unfortunately, and it's a sad indictment on where we are, but it's safety of our people first. I want to go to work and everyone wants to go to work and come home.
That's right.
No matter what.
Is this the one you wanted to, is there a fund?
Well, Charlie was telling us that you're the president, you're the ambassador of one of the Blue Ribbon branches, and so when you go and talk to the public,
because
you talk a lot and do a lot of things like doing it with us, you asked for donations to Blue Ribbon Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Blue Ribbon Foundation, people sometimes get confused with, you're Beyond Blue. No. When I speak to community groups, I ask for a donation just for my time because I lose a whole day. Because being the ambassador of the Westgate Blue Ribbon branch, and we channel all our funds into local hospitals, to the emergency hospitals and the likes of equipment and the likes, $100,000 here and there. Now, Blue Ribbon commemorates the loss of 159 police lives where police have lost their lives on duty servicing the community. And that goes from the 1800s and the likes. And in remembering those people, on the 29th of September, every year we have a commemoration day, which is like a bit of like Anzac Day. And it's great for the community to come together and wear the blue ribbons and the likes. And there's branches. We've got the Blue Ribbon Foundation. Under the foundation and throughout the state of Victoria are the branches. I happen to be part of the Westgate Blue Ribbon branch as the ambassador in raising funds. So that's where I ask for funds or donations to be made to my branch in the time that I give to the community groups. And we move on and we then were able to give back to the community and really commemorate. And we go away from this issue of the infamous Ned Kelly and the likes. Well, no one remembers when you give the three names of the three police officers that Ned Kelly murdered. It's all about Ned Kelly. Well, what about the three officers that he murdered? Well, that's where we should be. Mm. And it was a Blue Ribbon branch that actually had a major unveiling of their grave sites up at Glen Rowan, Benallaway. They lose sight of that fact. And, that's the whole issue. Is it the Australian way? But through Blue Ribbon, we're trying to really highlight that 159 police officers in servicing the community have lost their lives. They never came home. Silk Miller murders, the Wall Street murders and the likes, and these other murders we've had, and even the motor car accidents that police have lost their lives. They're at work and they never came home to their families.
Oh, that's it. Their wives and families at home or husbands and families at home. it must cross their minds constantly, hoping that their partner's going to walk back through the door again.
Because policing isn't, you know, we can't make policing 100% safe.
No.
It's a fact of life. People are running away from danger, and the emergency services, fire brigade, ambulance, police are running towards the danger.
And they're there to protect us, ultimately.
Very much so. And, you know, I do a lot of talks to the junior police members of letting them know that, look, guys, 90% plus of the community support you, but they're the silent majority. And, you know, and it's great, you know, to go along. And I know David Mann is the chairman of Blue Ribbon Foundation. And he makes it a point when he sees a police officer or a PSA officer, and he says it in the meetings we have, that he goes along and says, I want to shake your hand and thank you guys for the work that you do. And that comes as a surprise to the police officers.
Well, you know what? I think we forget how lucky we are. And I said to someone, another officer we spoke to not long ago, I remember that I have a friend from Iran who always says to me, you know, you guys don't understand how lucky you are. When you see police, it's a good thing. It's a comforting thing. When we saw police, it was not.
Yep,
when I grew up, seeing police, it was a terrifying thing. It never meant anything good. And I always think about times when my kids were little and we'd be walking along St Kilda and we saw a divvy van and the two young officers jumped out and said to the kids, do you want to jump in the back?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I think we Australians, it's one of the many, many things we don't realise we take for granted.
Very much so.
My local coffee shop, the police station's pretty close by. Two Cats in Boronia, I'll give them a shout out. They encourage customers, they buy the cops coffee so the cops come and get their coffees.
Yeah,
it's just
McDonald's.
A really simple thing.
It is. And realistically, you know, we had a chief commissioner in the past said, oh, no, that's corruption. You cannot accept the free gifts and this stuff. But
it's a coffee.
And McDonald's come out, and I remember, and they said, well, hang on a minute, you don't tell us how to run our business. We offer that to police because we want to see the uniform there.
It
is an incentive to a degree, but at the end of the day, you know, and that was the old police styling. And when I was here at Footscray CIB for 10-odd years, we'd go up the street, we'd know our local shopkeepers.
Yeah.
And we would go, oh, Charlie, look, this guy, you know, he dropped a check on us. Can you just ring him up and say, look, you better? You do. And to do that today, that's a form of extortion.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it's all about, you know, supporting the people, and they'd come to you.
Relationship building.
Community relationship building,
And that's where the interaction we've lost is so significantly. And what annoys me is, and us being here in the western suburbs, is we want to engage with the community, and how is the police department engaged? They've closed police stations.
Yeah.
They've closed Yarraville, Kingsville, Altona, Newport.
Yeah.
So they've made mega police stations. And I say to young police officers, I said, do you know how intimidating it is for a member of the public to walk into a police station, a major police. It is intimidating.
It is.
And you've got to give them the empathy.
Yep.
But that force doesn't flow on.
But also, as we've been talking about the hot button issue at the moment, you know, of gangs, whatever. Mm. I mean, we again talk about the fact that some of these young men come from communities where police are terrifying.
Correct.
And so if we want them to understand that in our community you are not their enemy.
Correct.
Then we need you to be in our community and we need them to be able to interact with you
very much
normally in the street, in the community, not just see you when they're in trouble.
Exactly. And that's where it's good they get the police. I've seen a few more police now booing foot patrols and the likes. That's where you've got to get to stop and talk to the people.
People love it, seeing the foot patrols.
Absolutely. And, you know, you see a police officer talking to, you know, you might see different ethnic groups that they're talking to and being involved in them. You know, neighbourhood watch type of things and all this type of thing, just interacting. We lost so much when we lost that schools involvement program.
Yeah.
We're trying to get that back now. We need that interaction. We are not the enemy. You know, we are there to help you. You are a community service police are a community service. The younger members got to understand that these are your customers.
Mm.
They're not a problem to you. They are your customers coming to you as a police officer and saying, you know what, someone just stolen my motor car. They look at you for a direction, assistance and support.
Mm.
You've got to give it to them as police officers. That's what your role is. You don't just say, tick, 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 here's your report, give it to the insurance company. Give them a bit of empathy. And I used to say to the young members, you've got to personalise it. The person you are dealing with is your mother, father, brother, son, uncle or auntie.
Mm.
It's a member of your family and treat them accordingly. And a lot of the community, unfortunately, go to these mega police stations. They get treated inappropriately by the police because they're under the pump. They're doing 15 or 20 burglary reports.
Yeah.
But the young members of today, the young police members have to understand this is the biggest thing that's happened in this person's life.
Yeah, he's so right. Yeah.
Give him a bit of empathy and say, you know what, guys? It's my experience that these burglars aren't going to come back. Maybe, look, we'll send our community support people out there and tell you how to improve your security, that type of stuff. But the police don't have that time. They don't have that luxury. They become mechanized, they're robotic. And all of a sudden, the person walks out the police station. He says, well, that was a waste of time, wasn't it? I had to redo it. And they walk away disgruntled with it.
Mm.
So we've really got to get better. The police have got to get better in that interaction and support of the community.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars, and to follow us on Facebook.